Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Another wonderful evening of broadcasting right here on LA Talk Radio. You are listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I have with me tonight my once-a-month co-host, Mr. Russ Avison.
Hello, hello. And we keep it at once a month so we can tolerate each other. We still like each other, right?
I love you, Russ. And, of course, we have our every week co-host, Miss Bobby Jean Bell, coming in wounded. She's like a little wounded bird from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh, so delighted to be here. It's so nice to hear your voice, Russ. Welcome.
Thank you. Same here. And you need to stay out of the bar fight so you don't have to get kicked off the shows. You. Jeez.
I'm telling you.
Yeah,
Jim just stands back and hands the bat. You know, that's what happens. He just stands back and hands with the bat and says, "I'm give me another beer."
That's good.
It would be more fun if it had happened that way.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, fighting with a minivan is not a lot of fun. So it's always fun when you guys are on together and all three of us are here because it gives us more time to talk about each other to our faces.
I can see what's really on my mind, huh?
Yeah, well, you always can, but now the world can hear you. And, of course, we're coming out to live. So anything that goes on in this show tonight goes out live. So go ahead, Russ, make a faux pas.
No, I'm not going to. But I want you to tell everybody about your dog. I mean, I think this is pretty awesome what Bella's doing.
My dog? Oh, I have a golden retriever. Her name is Bella, and now she has taken to – she gets peas and carrots mixed with her kibble in the morning and at night. And now she's taken – about the last week, she takes – and uses her nose and moves the peas out of the way and then eats the kibble and the carrots. And then she goes back and eats the peas.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't get that.
Did she learn that by watching you?
No, I don't eat peas. So it would have to be watching me eat the carrots.
Ah, okay.
But she gets carrots as a treat.
And she likes them.
Oh, she loves them. And when she was a puppy. In fact, this was your idea, freeze whole carrots.
Right.
And keep her from chewing on you, give her the frozen carrot, and she would, for hours, she would lay there on the floor and chew on this carrot. And it saved my arms and my hands, because as we all know, puppies have needle teeth.
Yes.
and Bella had some of the meanest needle teeth in town. She threw it. The other night when I was on the phone, she was, when I was actually talking to Chris, and she was trying to have sex with my leg.
I see.
Yeah.
We should probably move on now.
So I had to tell her no leg humping, Bella. No leg humping. Okay. So you guys are doing good.
Excellent.
COVID is treating you well.
You know, I just had a conversation with someone yesterday about this that a lot of people have gotten very depressed and down about, I mean, there's a lot of things that are really tough to be going through right now, but this is just a speed bump on the road through life. And, you know, we're going to get through it and you just, you know, you need to experience it. Just, you know, say, okay, this is what it is and let's make the best of it and move forward, but don't sit around and mope and feel, you know, I mean, my business, our boarding business is in the toilet, but you know, that's the way it is right now. And, you know, we'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it. Well, I'll tell you what. In order for us to keep from making more small talk, which I'm sure the people are just absolutely loving, why don't we hear, Maestro, a little bit of Cowgirl's Lament?
¶¶ It's a hard ride back to Belle Fouche. Northern prairies thick with snow. Lost the road out of Amadon. Still, I'll make it through to Buffalo. Soon, another silent sunset. It feels too cold to cry. Some sad beauty I leave alone here to die by the dark of night. So I'll strike myself a warm and fire, lay my old saddle down, sip on a hot cup of coffee.
Well, tonight's guest is a co-writer of that particular tune. It's called Cowgirl's Lament. It's going to be released next month, I believe, or on the 4th or the 7th of the month. And she is a New York Times bestselling author, a scriptwriter, comedian, who's written for television and film, performed on cruise ships and on stage. She is also one of two, count them on your fingers, two survivors of a TV show called, I forgot what it's called now. What is it called, Chris?
The survivor of a television show?
Yes, you mean- the one with Dead Files.
Oh, gosh, yes.
We had another guest that was on Dead Files, which was Johnny D. Boggs. So she also survived that. She's just a terrific lady. She's written about most of the big women in the West, and she's written about a lot of the ones that you never heard about. She's also getting into the modern-day cowboys now with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. And I mean, she's terrific, terrific lady. Had a great conversation with her the other night. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Ms. Chris Enns.
You guys are so wonderful to have me be a part of the broadcast. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, you're so welcome. I mean, you know, we've been talking about this for a couple of years now, and I just, you know, Bobby Jean has mentioned you, I don't know how many times.
Many.
And once in a while in a nice way.
Oh, always in a nice way. But, you know, and we, you know, did we, the protocols we had to go through to get, because we are so booked up that we have to go through to get on the show. I mean, like Chris mentioned the other night, she waited a long time since June last year to get on the, or maybe June this
year.
Yeah,
but what a wonderful problem for you guys to have. Don't you want to be in that situation where you
absolutely
just were there lined up around the block to get on your program to talk about writing and talk about, the books that have put together and talk a little marketing. I thought tonight we'd talk a little bit about that too for the first time authors who are listening in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Tonight, I actually, to start this off, this conversation for the next couple minutes, I'm going to talk about a book that's been out since, 2014. And you have it listed here in a PDF that I have on my computer. It's DRAS. However, it stands for
The Death Row All-Stars.
There you go. Death Row. Yeah. This is like the early 20th century, and these guys are on death row in Wyoming State Penitentiary, and they have a baseball team.
Yeah, I absolutely loved researching and writing this particular book, and have always, you know, I wrote it so it would lay out like it was a film, because indeed it was a story that really screams out to be seen in theaters. I mean, that's the true story of death row inmates that as long as they played baseball for the prison and won, they got stays of execution. And it's a true story that happened in 1911. And, I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. History is so amazing that you don't even have to come up with an idea for things. You just, that's just rich history that's laying around begging to be written about.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the one guy that unfortunate, the one unfortunate, Joseph Tseng, that did not make the cut.
Yeah. He made the cut. He just couldn't stick in there long.
He dangled from a rope on May 23rd, 1912. So, you know, it's amazing. The two executions that took place in the early part of Wyoming history and the early part of the 20th century, Tom Horn and Joseph Tseng, neither one of them, even though the technology was there, neither one of them died when they dropped. they both took, like, Tom Horn took 18 minutes to die. So did Ng. He took 18 minutes to die.
I know. I found that as, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I should let you finish your thought there. I was just going to say, it's amazing because Singh is hanged from what they call the Julian gallows.
Right.
And they came up with the Julian gallows because they thought it would be a little bit more humane because the guard wouldn't have to be the one to pull the lever that released the trap door, in which the inmate would go through the trap door, and then the rope was supposed to snap a guy's neck on the left side. And so he came up with Julian Gallows, which is all done with weights and pulleys. And it didn't work because the guards would have to go down and hold the inmate by the leg and then jerk him down.
Right.
I hope everybody's just eating some dessert right now, because this is more dessert talk than it is.
It is dessert talk. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Horn told the executioners, "You're going to make me go down there and hang myself." And they said, "Yeah, pretty much."
Yeah. It was a gruesome way to die. But I mean, that was a time in the history of the American West where they were just kind of. They were progressing too. You know, you have to progress with your executions. You have to find your way.
You know, but it's really interesting that the struggles they were going through and the debates and how they should do it. It's the same today as it was then. I mean, we're still talking about, are we using the right drugs? Should we really, should we be using drugs? Are they lasting too long before they die? Are they suffering? It's all the same.
Right. I think people are a little bit more concerned today about how that goes down for the inmate than they were back in Horn's time or Singh's time. They were just thinking about what was going to be more humane for the executioner. So that wouldn't be weighing on their conscience when they threw the trap door for the inmates in 1911 to drop through. It was more for the concern of the guard and how that was going to set with their souls than the inmates. I don't think they gave two hoots about what happened with the inmates there at the Frontier Prison there in Rawlins, Wyoming.
Well, do you remember the, what was his name, Gary, somebody, the Oregon execution where it was the last one where they shot them?
Oh, that was in Utah.
Or Utah, was it?
Gary Gilmore.
Gary Gilmore, right.
Yeah.
And what they do is there's one of the riflemen that has a blank bullet in there. And so they, for the same concern, as they didn't want them to think they were the one that killed him. So the one guard can always think, maybe I had the blank. I didn't actually shoot the guy. And it was, again, concern for how they would have to rest with the idea that they just killed this man.
Well, what's amazing is when you start the program out by saying, gosh, it's been a depressing time, but look at us. Look at us, mired even more so in depression.
I know.
With the talk of executions and how we do it. But, you know, I mean, the story of these death row inmates and how they came alive on the field playing baseball. And just I loved the whole image of these baseball players being wagoned to – put on the back of the wagon and taken to a field to play baseball, and they would be shackled in cuffs, and the kids coming up and asking them for their autographs. Now you talk about something that hasn't changed. I mean, we still have a lot of outlaws that are playing professional sports that people are looking for autographs from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, and they pretty much beat everybody they played. Of course, they were motivated.
Well, yeah, you got to be good. Your whole life hangs in the balance.
Right.
You know? So, yeah. But I think, especially when it came to Singh, I mean, they couldn't help but be good. I mean, Singh was this incredible baseball player, and the fact that he was in there for a murder that he may or may not have committed.
Which is another
big aspect of the book itself. It's about the crime that Singh has been put in there for, and how that all unfolds in the read. So The Death Row All-Stars is not just a baseball book, but it's also a book about this particular inmate and the other inmates who make up the team, for crying out loud. I mean, George Sabin, who is the captain of the team, is the warden's best friend. He's also the bag man for the team, so he's allowed to come and go when he pleases, so he could take the bets outside the prison. So it was a unique situation in history.
It was an amazing story, and you know, one would think that. Well, number one, that prison is not going to have a baseball team, especially at a death row, that's going to play all the teams around, but they did. You know, one another thing is that, you know, who's going to think you're going to commute your sentence? They did.
Right.
You know?
Wow. For the most part, you know, with the exception of the captain of the baseball team, I mean, they all, and the captain of the baseball team escaped. He escaped. They never did find him escaped. I think that the door was left open for him to go because he was the warden's best friend, stood up for the warden at his wedding. That was at a time in history too. George Sabin was the captain of that particular baseball team. And that was at a time in history in Wyoming where if you were a cattle rancher and you killed sheep herders, mm-hmm. which is what he did, you were more looked upon more as being a hero than an outlaw.
Well, sure, because, you know, we all know what sheep did to the grazing lands.
Yeah, and he was in there for killing sheep ranchers, but he wasn't treated so much like a criminal because the most of the people that ran the prison thought that he got a raw deal because they were pleased that he took care of the sheep ranchers.
Excellent.
I have a question.
Hang tough, Bobby.
Okay.
We're going to take a real quick break.
Oh, okay.
And you're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. We'll be back with Chris Enns and Bobby Jean Bell and what's his name? Russ Avison.
There he is.
Right after this brief word from Talk Radio. And you know, in these days of coronavirus and COVID-19, as you're sitting home at your desk doing your job, how about instead of watching reruns of Lassie and the Lone Ranger, you tune in to www.latalkradio.com and listen to what our hosts have to say during the day. We've got everything from sports to music to self-help to, well, we even have talk. So why not give us a try during the day, latalkradio.com. And remember, every Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, right here on LA Talk Radio, is the Writer's Block. Have a great day. And we are back. We are back with our guest tonight, Chris Enns, Russ Avison, and, of course, Bobby Jean Bell. And if you want to call and talk to Chris tonight, she's a wonderful conversationalist. The number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And, again, that number is 323-203-0815. Chris, you know, you've written about pretty much every famous woman that hung around in the West. You've written about Big Nose Kate. You've written about Little Sure Shot Annie Oakley. And it's just, I mean, what does it take for you to research these people? Now, I know you told me that you were a licensed private investigator, but that doesn't always give you a good basis for research, although it gives you a pretty good one. Researching a novel and researching a story can be real frustrating. So how do you go about it?
Well, I like to get my hands on primary sources, and I like to go to the spot where these stories happened, where these women, because I write a lot about women of the Old West, where they were homed, and start poking around from that point. And I love the deep dive on something. So, like, for example, you mentioned the Annie Oakley book. The book that I wrote about Annie Oakley is called The Trials of Annie Oakley. And it's not your typical Annie Oakley story. It's not Annie Oakley and the Buffalo Bill Cody show, because everybody knows about that. That's been done to death. The Trials of Annie Oakley is the story about the 6 years that Annie spent in court suing William Randolph Hearst for defamation of character. And I was able to get in and take a look at Hearst's original thoughts about that particular case, I was able to get in and research what each one of the editors at these newspapers that Annie Oakley sued, all 55 of the newspapers that Hearst owned at that particular time in the late 1919, 1918, around in there. And so just being able to get in there and find out what was going on with each one of these people and what they were thinking and what was on Annie Oakley's mind, and then getting the transcripts, getting the actual transcripts from the trial and going through those and learning about the characters through that. And that's how I constructed that book, and just being able to tell a story about some of these well-known characters that maybe no one has ever heard about. I love being able to do that, and that's just being able to track something from the most unusual sources. I spent a lot of time at the Library of Congress, and, you know, here's just a tip. Sometimes when you're looking up particular things, misspell a word. You're doing any research on Tucson, misspell the word Tucson, because a lot of people misspelled words. You find things in those that no one, the people have missed. So I love being able to get in and dig deep on an issue and find out things, as I say, that no one else knows anything about. That's the enjoyment for me. And being a private investigator, I only brought that up because it is that innate sense of wanting to track something to its natural conclusion that I think kind of translated well into writing about history.
Okay. Bobby Jean, I didn't mean to cut you off. Why don't you ask your question now?
Actually, that was the question I had. going back to the first book we talked about, I guess my question would be, how did you discover that story? Did you discover it sort of on your own, or did someone tell you, hey, Chris, you need to write about something, you know, you need to write about this? Where do the ideas come from? Then I am understanding how you're going about your research, but how did you stumble on that story?
I was at the prison doing some research on women who had been incarcerated there, and came upon this picture of these baseball players, baseball players. And what struck me about that particular picture was the 3-year-old, 4-year-old boy who was the bat boy in the middle of these serial rapists, these murderers, these just the worst outlaws imaginable. And I thought, who would let their little boy pose with all of these people as a bat boy, as though it's just? And so that's what sparked my interest about that. And then I found out that it was the warden's son. And I thought, why would the warden have any interest in that? That's bizarre. Which then led me to the next step. I absolutely loved being able to do the research for that. I mean, it led to information about a lot of the gambling schemes that were going on there in Wyoming at the time. But it came with a price. I mean, certainly when the book came out, I get letters from people saying that I have besmirched the game of baseball. And I was pretty well certain other people had done that, but okay. But that, and then I got letters from people from Wyoming saying that I made their state look bad. So, you know, it comes, sometimes those particular stories come with there's a cost to be paid for them. I mean, it's fine now. I mean, at first I was absolutely completely taken aback that people would say that I made baseball look bad. So, but then, you know, all was forgiven when the Death Row All-Stars was included into the Baseball Hall of Fame library. And I got this incredible letter letting me know that it is now in the Baseball Hall of Fame shelves.
Wow.
There you go. You know, I mean, talking about besmirching Wyoming, I'm looking here at a picture in your book of Big Nose George Parrott's death mask and shoes they made out of his skin.
Oh, my gosh. The shoes out of his skin.
Well, you know, I mean, there was a reputation about Wyoming as a whole, and in particular the Rawlins area, that if you committed a crime in Wyoming, you weren't going to just walk away like any other place. They were going to hunt you down, and they were going to find you. And in the case of Big Nose George Parrott, who, you know, was a thief, not only did they track him down, but, you know, he was killed, and then he was skinned, and there's shoes that were made out of his skin, and then they were placed in the window of the barber shop. So anybody coming into town, you know, you're going to have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. You don't want to perpetuate any crime here, because this is what's going to happen to you. Like these shoes could be yours if the price is right. You know?
Well, actually, they look like they could be your wife's. They look like women's shoes.
Well, they were kind of an Oxford style shoe. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, how do you buff skin to get a high sheen on any of those shoes? So, you know.
I suppose you tan the leather just like you would a cow or a...
I guess, but I mean, and so when it came time to think about where the state prison was going to be, there was no question that it'd be Rawlins. This is how they handled criminals. So, you know, it earned its reputation.
Well, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious, Chris, because it's obvious that you did a lot of very intense and thorough research. I want to go back to George Saban a minute, because he did escape. Nobody ever caught him. Do you have any thoughts on maybe what did happen to him? I mean, I was thinking maybe he changed his name and started a new life or did something. Do you have any ideas?
I think probably Felix Alden, the warden, helped get him out and helped get him where he was going to go. I believe also other politicians who were also gambling on the team helped him. They had a financial interest in being able to make sure that he was safe and secure. I mean, for all I know, maybe somebody bumped him off at that time, dead men to motels. But I believe that he was secreted out, and I believe that Felix knew the whole time what was going on and kind of aided in that. So...
Huh.
I didn't really pursue that any further. I that would be really interesting. That's another one of those Old West cold cases,
right?
Always interesting to find out. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of like I've written quite a bit. I was telling Jim this the other night. Going through my books, I've written more about prostitution in the Old West than pretty much anything. But doing research on soiled doves of the Old West was really hard, like it would be to try and track what happened with George, because prostitutes would change their name. They could be Squirrel Tooth Alice in Dodge City, but then
that's,
you know,
appealing.
Slinkin' Kate in San Francisco. So
right.
You can't really Squirrel Tooth. She didn't really have squirrel teeth. She just kept. She kept prairie dogs. Every prostitute in the Old West, the ones that made lots of money, had to have a something that pulled people in business-wise, you know, something. And Squirrel Tooth Alice...
Well, I think they all had something. It was the same.
Well, they all had something. But you had to differentiate your something from the other person's something. So
sure.
It was gimmickry. A lot of gimmicks were used in the field of prostitution. And so Squirrel Tooth Alice liked prairie dogs, and she kept them as pets, and she kept them on leashes around her house of ill repute. And but they called them squirrels, but they weren't. They were prairie dogs. So a lot of the images that you ever see of Squirrel Tooth Alice, it's her posing with her prairie dogs.
How do you...
Not in an unusual manner, but just, you know, her fully clothed posing with her...
Sure, but it would just set her aside, so people say, "Oh, she's got to be interesting."
Mm-hmm. That's right. You didn't want to be. You don't want to be boring. Not even as a prostitute did you want to be boring.
Hey, I wanted to ask also. You know, it was really, as I said, I was very aware of how much research you put into this book just in reading it, and so it actually started me doing some research. I started looking up some of the other people, and, you know, kind of going down different rabbit holes to find out what happened to some of these people. But it was interesting that there are different sources that will cover the same subject and have completely different spins on what actually happened. How do you, as a journalist and researcher, pull out the things that, you know, that you're fairly sure that are the accuracy that you want to have in the book, rather than something that, well, so-and-so said this, but maybe that's what happened?
Well, if you look at my book, I always feel like my end notes and my bibliography are much more than the actual content of the book, because I don't want anybody to say, you made that up, I don't know where you got that, that came from no place. I try to have at least three sources for every one of the points that I bring up in there. And so, you know, everybody's going to have their different opinion about what happened. You know, and I always go back to that wonderful line from the man who shot Liberty Valance, where fact is absent, print the legend. So there's just some things that are going to always be legendary. I don't know how you're ever going to get to the actual bottom of it, because even when it came to things like the gunfight at the OK Corral, people saw different things. And depending on what newspaper you read, it had a different take on it. That's kind of like the news today. You can
spin is everything.
Watch CNN and get one side of the news, and Fox, and think that's not at all what they said on CNN. So, you know.
Spin is everything. Hey, we're gonna take another real quick break, and we'll be back. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. And we'll be back here in about 30 seconds, right after we hear a small word from All Dogs Rule.
And I'm really not going anywhere. Hey, you know, imagine deep blue skies, majestic mountains, and acres of lush green orange trees in a tranquil country setting. Sounds like a perfect vacation spot, and it is for your dog. That's right, All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Whether you're going away for a one- or two-night getaway or an extended vacation, All Dogs Rule is the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. And when your dog returns home, you'll have to ask, whose vacation was better? Check them out at their website, alldogsrule.com, or give them a call at 805-524-1100.
And if you are looking for a dog trainer, go no further than this program, because the best dog trainer in the world just spoke to you. That's Mr. Russ Avison. He did. And he's got a great technique, and he teaches the owners, not the dog, which I think is a great idea, because I have a hard head. So,
yeah, Jim's my longest running client. We're still not there yet.
that is absolutely true. Okay. Thanks, Russ. So if you want to call and talk to Chris or Russ or Bobby or, God forbid, me, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. Again, that number, write it down, 323-203-0815. And you can call the next 15 minutes, and we'll talk to you live. I have a question. Not a question, maybe a comment. There's a lot of things that there's a lot of history that you can pull up from all this research that everybody seems to want to do. I mean, when I wrote a book called Bugles in the Sun, I did almost a year's worth of research. And it took me forever to get the truth, glean the truth out of so many factoids that weren't true about Custer's last 20 days of going from Fort Abraham Lincoln to the Little Bighorn. A good example is the night before they took off from the Yellowstone heading down towards the Rosebud, there was a party on board the Far West steamer. And most of the officers in the companies, there was several poker tables set up, and they were all pretty hammered and playing cards all night. And a lot of the troopers stood by the side of the river and watching this going on. At one point, Custer Stryker watched Tom Custer come out and throw up over the side of the boat and then go back in. So, I mean, but this is parts of history that a lot of people don't know about. But then they also have things that they tout and they talk about all the time that virtually never happened. Did you find that in your research and this book or any book that you've written?
Oh gosh, yeah. You find that an awful lot, and I think people just kind of fill in gaps that they don't know anything about, or, you know, I mean, there is some history that's written about. It's a machine, and it is, people have tried forever to make that spin stick. Like you talk about Custer. I mean, there are certain things that you write about that you know, if you write about them, it's like sticking your head in a fan. Writing anything about the Little Bighorn is that way, or anything about the Earps is that way. There's a machine that wants to make sure that the image of the Earps are kept one way. I'm not necessarily saying that they are wrong in doing that. It's just that there are, there's plenty of information out there that, especially when I was writing the Big Nose Kate book, I mean, she did not like Wyatt Earp, and he did not like her either. For years, everybody always said her name. She was called Big Nose Kate because she was Hungarian and because she had a big nose. But that's not at all how she got the name. She was called Big Nose Kate because whenever Wyatt Earp would show up and want to take off with Doc, she would ask, where are they going? You know, Doc and I've got this good life together. I don't know where you're taking off with them. Where are you going? And Wyatt would say, get your big nose out of my business.
Oh.
That's just one of those things where people automatically say, oh, it's because she's got a big nose. That's not at all what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just being able to write, like you just said about the Little Bighorn, I mean, that's some brave territory you ventured into. I don't know. I mean, usually if you say anything, you know, most people want to read a book that says what an absolute moron or egomaniac Custer was. And there's no question about the fact that he was an egomaniac. But, boy, don't you ever mention, especially with Custer, you know, I mean, this guy went to West Point. And at West Point, they train their cadets to divide their troops into thirds, which is exactly what he did when he was mm-hmm. at the Last Stand. But everybody says, oh, he did that just because he was egotistical and thought he could take them. You know, he just fell back to what he was taught when he was in school.
Right. But he also was the last in his class.
Yeah, last in his class. So, you know, so there wasn't a lot of, he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer when it came to that. But, you know, I guess my point is there is some history that people are bound and determined to keep it as they like it.
Sure.
We're not going to go out. They just don't want you to go outside of that purview.
Sure.
And writing about Big Nose Kate was one of those areas. Kate says that she was at the, she watched the gunfight at the OK Corral from the window, from Doc's window that he had at Fly's photography studio and boarding house. She says that after the fight, Doc came back into the room. He had been grazed across the hip with a bullet. And he came back into the room and he sits down at the edge of the bed and puts his head in his hands and says, my God, what have we done? And she writes that he was crying. I don't think it was full on sobs. I just think, you know, he was mm-hmm. crying. And there's so many people who say, oh, for goodness sake, that would never happen. He never did that. But, you know, they were lovers. And you say things to a person that you're romantically involved with that you don't say to the guys. So I can't automatically discount that because Kate said it. And everybody wants to not believe Kate because she was a prostitute.
Right. Right.
But there is a whole... There's a whole business that want you to not listen to somebody like Kate, because it wouldn't be in their financial interest to make Wyatt out to be somebody that is not a hero.
Yeah, because
if that makes any sense at all.
Absolutely.
I have a quick question. Chris, you have written about so many topics. If you had a choice, is there anybody you really wish you could sit across a table from that you've written about and really get the real scoop?
Yes, I wrote a book called The Pinks,
Yes.
Which is the story of the first female Pinkerton detectives at the Pinkerton Detective Agency. And I would love to be able to talk with Kate Warren, who was the very first female Pink who went into the agency in 1856 and asked Alan Pinkerton for a job. And he said, "I'm sorry, we are not looking for any secretaries." And she says, "I know, but I want to be a detective. I think I can get into places that you couldn't do, your agents couldn't do because they're men. So give me a chance." And he does. And they don't even history. Some history doesn't even want Kate Warren to even have that. I mean, she's this amazing detective. Turns out to be this phenomenal agent who ends up being the head of what we now know as the Secret Service. But, you know, a lot of people want to take that away from her in history. They want to say, well, you know, of course she got the job because she ends up sleeping with Alan Pinkerton. I mean, after all, she is buried in the Pinkertons' section of their cemetery. But it's only because Kate didn't have a family of her own. She didn't have anybody. And that's the reason why. But a lot of times, and so I'd love to be able to sit and talk with Kate, because I think some women like Kate get robbed of their true contribution mm-hmm. to history, because people always want to make it like, well, of course she did, because they were sleeping around. And that was not the case. That absolutely was not the case. I found no evidence to support that. But a lot of people think that all you have to do is support it, is to say, well, she's buried in the same area, plot area, as Pinkerton's family. So there's your proof, which is not proof.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if I was sitting with Kate, I'd say, hey, what do you have to say about these people saying you slept with Alan?
Yeah. Yeah.
How was he?
Yeah. I'd want to talk to her, too, about some of the amazing cases that she went on, because she had an interesting way of getting into some of these places. I mean, she went to investigate a case in Mississippi where money had been stolen from this bank, and the teller had been bludgeoned to death with what looked like a hammer. Terrible, bloody crime scene. But she goes down there with a couple of other agents, and the Pinkertons were unusual because they weren't there to find the murderer. I mean, there was all kinds of evidence that would lead you to believe that you know exactly who the murderer is. They were there to get the money. She's sent there to find out where that money is, and by gum, she gets it. But the way she goes about doing it is she finds out the guy who has robbed the bank, who has murdered this teller, and befriends this guy's wife, and they go horseback riding, and they own this amazing plantation, and she falls off her horse and pretends to be very hurt in front of their plantation, so they will say, come on in, we will take care of you here, we're so sorry that this happened. And that's exactly what they do. They bring her in, and that's what she's hoping for, because throughout the course of, I think it was 3 or 4 months, maybe it was 6 months, I can't remember, it was an extended period of time, she starts to gaslight this guy by leaving trails of blood from his bed to different areas of the house. And then one night when he goes outside of the house following this trail of blood, this murderer looks up through the trees and he sees one of the other agents dressed up to look like the man that he murdered. So the back of his head is all bashed in. Anyway, she takes this guy on a nightmare trail, and eventually he doesn't even know that she's watching, but he leads her right to where the money is.
Oh my God. Wow.
Amazing.
Amazing.
This is a question that we ask. If you're sitting down and you're relaxed, here's the question. The name of this program is The Writer's Block. And have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get out of it?
I have to tell you, I write nonfiction, and I'm usually working on 3 books at a time. So if I get stuck on one, if I get stuck on one story, I usually go to another book that I'm working on. And by the time I've worked on that particular book, I become unstuck with the other thing. So I think always having more than one project that you're working on is very helpful. You're not so focused that you can't see the light of day.
Gotcha. Okay.
I mean, that's essential. I mean, the other thing is I spend so much of my time working on promotions for the books that I write. I think a lot of authors just kind of, they don't want to do that because it's not the attractive part of writing.
Right, exactly.
But you have to do it, and you have to let people know where your books are, because if people can't find your book, they can't read your book. So whenever I feel like, oh boy, I don't really even know where to go with this story, I might go to another story, or I might spend a lot more time working on promotions for the books that I've already written.
Okay. That's a good answer. That's actually a very good answer. And with that, we're going to take another real quick break. And this is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block. And we'll be back right after the short word from Creative Edge Publicity. Hi, Jim Christina from The Writer's Block here with some great big news. If you're an author or inspiring to be one, then you better check this out. Creative Edge, one of Canada's top boutique publicity firms for authors, is now expanding. They are dedicating themselves to promoting authors, indie and traditional, in all walks of life, all genres, and they're looking for all opportunities. Owned by Mickey Mickelson, Creative Edge has the passion, the contacts, and the knowledge to help authors and other artists build their brand,
off
get their work
track,
noticed.
Though.
You can contact
but
Mickey
Chris,
at
I,
mickey.creativeedge.com.
I see you have quite a Western wardrobe.
To get started. Or you can go to www.creativeedge.com.
You have so many wonderful pictures of you dressed so many different kinds of ways. You must have a huge closet.
I have all of my clothes in my home. I don't know where my husband has his. Some of them are in his car. I've taken over all space in the house with that. And I have a wardrobe out in my garage where I keep a lot of my longer costumes. But yeah, I like to go out and do book events where you're dressed mm-hmm. like that particular period of time that you're writing about. It kind of pulls people into history, and they don't feel so disengaged.
Yeah,
that and any time that I can wear a corset and suck this all in for some reason, I'll do it.
I love it.
You did write a very important book. Back in, I think, early 2000, about how the West was worn. So you obviously have an affinity for the topic.
Well, I'm fascinated with that too. I mean, just give you an example. Any people who were coming west, any peoples that were coming west who were from a very influential background and had money, their babies that they brought with them west were fitted in diapers that had special tabs for their children to not a person of means. You whip stitched your baby into the diapers. There was a lot of diaper rash on the way west from just the average settler because nobody's going to stop, take those stitches out, whip stitch the kid back in again with a fresh diaper. So, that's right. Just little things about how they dressed and the meaning for what they were wearing. Certainly you could always tell you could tell where a person was from by their hat and by their boots. Mm-hmm. You didn't even have to hear what they said. You just look at them and go, okay, that guy's from Texas. That guy's from New Mexico. You just knew.
Gotcha. You know what, Chris? We are almost out of time. We got about 2 minutes left.
How is that even possible?
I have no idea. Look, I'm gonna do something that I don't normally do. I'm gonna talk to the book. I'm gonna get you booked first part of next year. And I
would
love to have you come back with us, because this has been a great conversation and we're not even half done.
Yeah, so, I would love to be able to do that. Love to be able to share more marketing tips with writers and just
well, we didn't bring how, to it.
How key that is. But yeah.
I'd love to have you back. Now, where are you gonna? Where can they find your books, and where are you going to be?
You can go to chrisentz.com. That's C H R I S E N chrisents.com. It's Chris Entz. Entz is German. It means help. There's a hog in my kitchen. So just remember that. So it's chrisents.com. And I'm going to be doing a special little Christmas giveaway. It's a bundle of books. You can go and starting at the top of December, you can go on my site and register to win. It's 12 autographed copies of books that you can give away at Christmas time. And just do that through chrisents.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we appreciate you spending the time you spent with us tonight.
And I love it. I love to be able to share with folks.
And we certainly do hope that you will agree to come back and see us next year.
Anytime. We could stay on the line right now.
I know.
Keep talking.
I know. I'm up for it. Unfortunately. So anyway, well, thanks again, Chris, and have yourself a great rest of your evening.
Thank you very much, and thanks for playing a bit of Cowgirls Lament. Hope you like
our
it.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. And I'll have the bookie get a hold of you, and we'll see if we can't get you booked. She's not booking anything until next month, but she'll let you know what day.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, folks. I appreciate it. Have a good night.
You too.
Good night, Chris. Bye-bye.
December 3rd, our guest is Craig DeLuey. And next week, of course, is Thanksgiving. We'll be dark, but we will be having a best of running. So tune in and you can always email me at jimchristina@yahoo.com and tell me if there's a particular show that you'd like to be rerun. And we'll be more than happy to do that for you. Okay, with that being said, Bobby Jean, thanks for popping in.
Thank you.
It was nice to hear you. It's been a long time.
It's great to hear you, Russ.
It is. And Russ, always, always great talking to you.
It is, isn't it?
It is. I know it is. My best to Karen.
Thank you.
And Bobby, my best to Jim.
Thank you.
And for Russ Aviston and Bobby Jean Bell, myself, Ronan Rosner, and of course, Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.